Hey, John.
Hola, how's it going?
It's going so well. We're back. It's episode 2-2.
It's episode number 22. We're so glad to be back. This week, we have friend of the show, Aaron Bells on. Aaron Bells is a man of many talents and a cousin of mine, actually. So Aaron is a poet and writer. He's been a professor. He currently works in marketing. Working for Fidelity Bank, doing both kind of marketing written materials and also UX and UI design, kind of user interaction stuff, which is super interesting because we wanted to talk to somebody who has been working with the English language for a long time, who is now doing that in a business context. And he talks about the intersection of poetry and business writing, as well as a lot of other things. This episode flies off the rails a few times, and there's a lot of lulls in there.
A lot of banter.
A lot of banter. Yeah, so we'll see if you can stick with it for the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's not for everyone.
Aaron's also a prolific tweeter. His Twitter account is great. If you want to go check that out, put a link to that in the show
It
notes.
really is a good one.
He's also got a few poetry books and some really great videos of readings. Links to all of that will be in the show notes below.
Let's mention real quick the Patreon. So last episode we announced the introduction of our new Patreon where you can give us your money and we will give you some content and
Cha-ching.
a sticker.
Since we announced our Patreon last week, I'm curious, to know if some of our newer listeners were thinking, I'd like to support this because I appreciate that they're doing it without ads, and I'd like to continue to support Fits and Starts because I believe in what's going on there. But I'm just not sure if the awesome group of people who are already patrons is awesome enough for me. Could you let them know who is already kind of in this stratified class of Fits and Starts patrons?
Thank you, listener, for that very earnest and unscripted question. Yes, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, I'm just going to let you know real quick that our monoliths, that is our big money patrons, we got a couple of those. We got Dan and John swinging in there as monoliths.
Thank you, Dan and John.
We got a handful of $5 ducks. We got Dustin, Jake, and Marcus swinging in as a $5 duck a piece.
Love you guys.
And then we got Raphael and Steven swinging in as mensches.
Beyond just the support, you're going to actually find a lot of bonus content on there. So didn't really explain that last time very carefully, but last week we talked to Mike Ragnetta, who does a lot of critical theory and cultural critique, and we talked to him about Lil Wayne. Daniel's been dying to talk about Lil Wayne in the program for quite some time, and so we finally
And I
got
got
around
to.
to talking about Lil Wayne, and it was actually terrific. I love it. This week, the bonus content on there is we do a deep dive on the Twitter account of Captain D's and talk about how fast food uses social media, and Aaron has some insights about how that's used, and it's very funny.
Yeah, and then we have the video content for the monoliths. So last week, I actually gave the video content to everyone because I just wanted to, tease a little bit. So last week I did an extravaganza where I demoed my backpack, and then John and I talked about the strategy of a day bag.
Incredible.
This week I think we're going to be playing a little bit of Fortnite together, and we may even get our good friend Jake Bathman to play with
Ooh,
us.
Jake. Friend of the show, Jake
Oh,
Bathman.
Jake. $5 duck,
There's
Jake
also some
Bathman.
other stuff on there. We got our stickers in. The stickers are very handsome. You've got a big pile of them. I'm gonna be littering San Francisco with Fits and Starts stickers pretty soon here.
Yeah, I love that they ship the stickers in bricks. It feels like I got the plug in Medellin.
So you can find all of that on the wonderful Patreon page, which link to that is at the top of your show notes right below this episode. Last but not least, we as starting last week, we decided we want to start promoting some of our friends' stuff. Friend of the show, Zay Smallman, who was on episode number 10, Strapped to the Mast, which is one of my favorite episodes.
Really quite an episode.
Zay is the co-founder of Mama Bear Studios, and Mama Bear has launched a new movie that they produced called Davion that just went to Sundance and is getting some awesome reviews. I'm going to put links down there in the show notes. You can rent it on YouTube, you can buy it on Amazon. It's an awesome movie, and you should go watch it. So we'll have to break this into two sessions, because usually our sessions are about 6 to 7 hours long.
Yeah, 6 to 7 hours. So we want to start with your birth. Please tell us about the conditions of your birth.
And actually, before we get into any real topics, I kind of like to figure out what our guests have as sort of their like presumptions or sort of like presuppositions coming into however they shape their own narrative. So if you could kind of lay out kind of just a philosophical framework for the way you think about everything before launching into that, that would actually be helpful.
Yeah, sure. So your birth and then a quick rundown of sort of the world as you see it that you entered into.
Start with first principles.
So I have a question before I answer those questions. How do I know if you guys are kidding? Is there some kind of a... something that pops up?
There's a special Skype add-on you can get for that.
Okay.
So it'll kind of project out like a clown face, and underneath it'll say LOL, and that's how you'll know that we're being facetious before you give your answer.
Oh, that makes total sense.
So for a while, we were actually contracting out to a company that did sort of... natural language processing and machine learning to sort of, you know, monitor the call and try and detect it. The issue with that was that their notifications were just really laggy. And so, you know, 7 or 8 seconds after a joke, you'd just get a little buzz on your phone that said, ha ha. But by that point, I was already...
By 7 seconds in, he was onto a serious
issue. I was onto a serious note.
I thought Daniel was joking about really important issues of our day. Yeah,
that's
the
good.
Tech was good. It was a little bit laggy.
It sounds like it would be good for that company to be called Ha Ha Haptic.
Oh yeah, it gives you a little.
Yep. Just a little electric shock that makes you feel funnier.
Mm. It goes.
You can feel it in your pocket. Hey, that's good. That's actually not a bad idea.
Now we're cooking with content.
That's right. It's interesting to me to have you on as somebody who thinks really carefully about language and has studied language at length and now works in arguably the place in America, in modern America, that is butchering and abusing language maybe more than any other arena at this time. So I would love to hear kind of your thoughts on... the way language is like used and abused in marketing, and also just more generally kind of in the workplace right now.
Well, for instance, John, arenas don't butcher things. And I guess you meant something, but it came out in a way that I can't really understand unless I accept some kind of a fiction connected to...
Hey, listener, this is about us correcting other people. This isn't about you correcting me.
Okay, but I'm just saying, you can find it at every level. And that particular kind of mixed metaphor is just one of the many problems with corporate communication. I have to be able to make a connection between the word and the thing that it's talking about. And when I hear so many words in corporate America used without thought... Then I have to back up, and that's why I love working at where I work, which is Fidelity Investments. I absolutely love it. And it's not like ironic. It's not like me having some fun, or it's not like an elaborate performance art. And it's also not really pouring myself out to the man. I think if I had done this in my 20s or 30s, I would have felt that way about it. But there's a more authentic way of doing things. Actually, the problems with language are across the whole spectrum of usage. Even in normal daily conversation, I hear a lot of stuff. I kind of feel like that little kid that sees dead people. And or another way is to think about it as the Matrix guy that sees all the bullets slow down in the air in front of him. I hear those cliches and idioms and words and different kinds of syntax and very like subtle regionalisms I hear. I track all that stuff. I hear the regionalisms. I don't mention it most of the time, but it feeds my poetry. It helps me write poetry because I'm hearing a slightly different way of framing something. In the South, there are many wonderful forms of expression. And in Southern literature, you can see see all that. And sometimes you don't even know why it seems Southern. But that's because the Southern writer has such a mastery of the language. So working for Fidelity has been fascinating because it's a lot like writing poetry, because what I work on is UX language and transactional language in mobile and in desktop. And when you're doing transactional language, you have a very brief moment to explain a fairly complicated process to people who may or may not already know what happens in that process. And so you can't talk down to anyone. It can't sound like you're teaching a 101 class on something. It has to sound like a friendly handshake for someone who already knows what they're doing, but it has to seem like easy guidance for someone who doesn't. So that's a complex target. You know, to hit that target takes a lot of work if you want to do that in two sentences. So I think it's a difficult and very interesting job. It keeps my mind working. And honestly, a lot of stuff I see that comes out of Silicon Valley, I think that is friendly and also kind of smarty pants. And I wouldn't write it. I think that's not cute, you know?
Yeah, there's a funny discussion going on right now in the tech community about whether or not things like voice assistants or menus should be kind of like jokey and human. Because in some ways, you really don't want that, because it just adds friction to the process and can be occasionally infuriating.
And insulting, depending on your situation in life. If you're in an emergency or you just had a father or a mother die or something, and then you ask Siri for something and she's like, "Are you sure that's what you meant?" I would smash my phone, you know? I mean, and I'd hurt myself only by doing that. So I don't want that kind of language.
MailChimp released their sort of language style guide a couple of years ago. Have you seen that?
I haven't.
It's really good. And like one of the things that they do is they have contexts for different voices. So for example, like they have like, and they sort of marry it with their design style guide. So basically they'll say like, you know, if something is on red, then it's like an error message and something went really wrong and you're never allowed to make a joke in this context. Right, because we've now just inconvenienced the user, and that's not funny to them, and right. So we're not going to like make a joke. But like when we send the success message for like, you know, your campaign is doing really well, like then you can put like a little jokey twang in your language there.
I would totally love to see that. One of the things we do at Fidelity is work on error messages, and I have 25 years of hitting a lot of errors in my head. As a resource, but error messages are fun because it's almost friendlier to be very abrupt in an error message, direct, and say what I've made a case a couple years ago, and I still push it, never to apologize, but always to be humble. So I would never say, "We're sorry, but your account is not available right now." You know, that's not. I don't think we need to be sorry. I want to say just straightforwardly, you can't access this thing. And then we also have, and this wasn't my invention, this is something we already had as a policy, as often as possible, provide a remedy in the same sentence. If we can't provide a remedy, provide some kind of a deeper sense of an outcome. But an error message has to be quick. And so that's so fun. I don't think I think a lot of people that think art is art, and that's kind of a high calling, like a noble priesthood, may not understand that when you work in language arts, you're also working with language the same way. At least you should be. There's anything spiritually superior to working in the arts than to working in commerce. I mean, Chaucer was a tax collector, so... He's one of my favorite all-time poets. If you think of what a poet is to the world of literature, which is a poet writes in a much smaller space, in a much more compact form of expression, then that's what a UX writer is to corporate communications. I mean, we're kind of on this very delicate edge of language in corporate America. And it's hard to, it's dumb to say corporate America. Really, that's not the word. It's more like in consumer America, or I don't know what the, I really don't know what the word is there. It's not corporate to the user. It doesn't seem corporate. I think when I'm a user, like maybe it was like 15 or 20 years ago, I first started obsessing over shampoo bottles and really reading them. And that was a sort of a shower time thing.
That seems like the best time to do that.
Yeah, you don't want to take them out because they're usually kind of, there's some condensation on them, or
a little bit of soap scum. Yeah.
Yes. So, but if you really read the paragraph or so that's on the back of every shampoo bottle explaining its virtues as a product, I never really thought about the fact that there are people out there that are writing this that have a job writing for shampoo companies. And so they write the packaging copy. And for me, it was more like this. I knew theoretically that was true, but in my practical experience, it wasn't me experiencing corporate America. It was me interacting with this physical thing that was in my shower stall, you know? And reading something about Paris and the fragrant breeze or something, and how my hair needs to be moisturized, even when it feels like it already is. You know, I mean, they make some arcane points about hair management that I think, wow, that's really super specific and very poetic. The only context in which that would make a lot of sense is on a shampoo bottle, that those few words, you know? So
where else are you going to find shine-enhancing nutrients?
Precisely, which is a great kind of form of expression also.
Keratin, yeah.
It's a packaged phrase. But it's also, I mean, I just think it does call attention to the beauty of the language. There are things on the side of a Nexus bottle or a Paul Sebastian bottle that will blow your freaking mind. And it's because those people they're not writing for hoity-toity critics. No, there are no critics in their world except their managers. Whatever marketing report they get saying how many people bought that shampoo bottle. But really, I don't think they can test packaging language for shampoo bottles to see if it increases sales. What's it actually doing on there? What does it do?
Well, it's the same kind of weird dynamic as like broadcasting, because you have somebody saying something that is going to go out to many, many people, but is going to be heard on an individual basis with each of those people, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So it is corporate. It is meaningfully corporate in that it is going out to thousands or tens of thousands or millions of people, but each individual person in that group will read it kind of on an individual basis.
That's right.
An individual sort of relationship with
it. So we'd say it's ontologically, it is a corporate thing. But in the empirical experience, there is no corporate. It's not,
right.
You don't think, right, oh, this is corporate messaging. You just watch it or absorb it.
I remember when I was, what would I have been, like 12, 13 years old? Hillary Clinton was doing a book signing in St. Louis. You had seen some talking George W. Bush dolls at the store. There were, I think, a couple dozen of them. And they would say things like strategery, or what were the other phrases that he would say?
I'm from Texas.
And you...
it was a string. Okay, it was a doll with a string.
We bought like 20 or 30 of them. And then... drove down to the Hillary Clinton book signing, walked around in line, and sold these things for three or four times their original price.
We got 10 bucks a piece. We got 10 bucks a piece, but we also got people telling us, you shouldn't have those here, really angrily. Some misguided progressives.
But a lot of people loved them.
It was like an immediate litmus test for who had any sense of irony or a sense of humor.
Yeah, well, and then I think NPR interviewed.
Did they? There's a thing there that's fascinating to me, which is that I worked for 10 or 15 years just in schools and in academic environments. And there are actually a lot of writers in academic environments, would-be and actual writers. By actual, I mean published authors, And because that's where they tend to collect, because that's where they can get a paycheck. And for some people, that seems like a very lazy kind of, well, I guess I'll teach. And it doesn't do any great service to the students who may have a brilliant writer as a teacher, but otherwise not a very good teacher. So there's a kind of, it's kind of a cesspool of creative geniuses. That's what colleges are. Well, I used to give poetry readings, and it was like pulling teeth, to use a terrifying cliche, by the way. It's like pulling teeth to get people to come out to readings. And then the first reading I gave, where it was announced around the office at Fidelity, like 25 of my coworkers showed up. And they were all like half drunk, and they were all just having an excellent time. And I read, and they absolutely loved it. And then the next few days, that's all they talked about at work. I'm not exaggerating. It was very, it impressed that community deeply to have a poetry reading coming out of one of its. I even had a guy that sat next to me, and now I work closely with him, and I know him a lot better. But this was in the first 6 months that I worked at Fidelity. A guy that sat next to me, he came up to me the next day. And he's like, "Unbelievable!" He goes. And here I sat next to you this whole time, and I didn't know. I had no idea. I had no idea. And that kind of thing never happens in the academic world. I mean, people don't care. They don't honestly care that you're a poet. That seems like something probably thousands of academics are. But working in financial services, it's much different from what other people's,
you're a real novelty,
quote, hobbies are, you know? Yeah, and I think it's moved past that. It was initially seemed like it was on the annoying side going to be like the team poet, you know?
every team's got one.
That's right. Like a belly button. Can't explain how it got there.
Uh-huh. Darned if you know how to use it.
We know how it got here, but we don't know how to use it. You do feel a little bit like a mascot in certain settings, like the token poet. And in our family, I felt that way. At a family event, like, do you have something to read? Like, I'm sure that people who do music
have
or
you
do
prepared a few words for this occasion.
Yeah. What are you going to? What thing are you going to read? Or did you write something? Or, and it was that way out in Hollywood too, where. In the community of actors and comedians where I've hung around, being a poet was just about the strangest thing. There were no poets and there were people who thought poetry was great and who knew a lot about poetry. I don't know anybody else that was in the variety show scene who came in and was like, I'm a poet. You'd have someone juggling baby bears earlier than that, you know? But it's changed at work. I think they see that the poetry that I write and the way I think about language is so integral to the way I work on content at work, they see the similarity. They see me as of a piece, not like I do a day job and then have this cool thing I do on the side. You know, I think they can see that it's all connected. I even told them at a meeting that I write poems at meetings sometimes when they think I'm taking notes. And they're like, oh, don't tell anybody that. But they were all there. So I don't know who I would tell. Everybody was there.
Well, you know, it's interesting too, because you used to, I remember even when I was in high school, you used to talk about this. I haven't heard you say it as much recently, but you've said to me on a number of different occasions that you think everyone should just be writing poetry. Not even with the intention of necessarily making good poetry, just people ought to be trying to write poetry, certainly more than they are right now. Do you still feel that way?
Poets should, yeah. Do you mean just a?
Do
you think I meant everybody?
Do you think everyone should?
You said regarding students, they don't want to be there and they have no pride in their work.
When it comes to writing,
yeah. Right? Well, yeah, maybe just that. But it gels perfectly with my experience. Like I. in my own life, that was definitely true. I didn't want to be there and I had no pride in my work. But why though? Like, what is it about, like, okay, now I'm in this place and I'm getting paid to do something. And like, so now I have to have pride in my work. Like, it seems like just as likely that I'm going to go there and have no pride in my work and just get a paycheck. Is it something about like the fact that a student just feels like being in college is something that they're doing so that they can go do their real thing later? And that once you've sort of hit the working world, you're like, well, I guess this is my real thing. Like, this is all the identity I'm ever going to get. So I may as well make the most of it.
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. It really has to do with the nature of schooling, which is not to start people on a life of learning, which is what it ought to be. It ought to be the first, getting people sort of set up. Here's how to go to a library. Here's how to read. Here are some facts about the past that you should, that will help you to know as you begin your life as a learner. Here's how teachers teach. So when you go out by yourself, you can teach yourself. You know what to look for, you know? And I think that's teaching people how to learn so that they will be naturally curious and they'll be good citizens was kind of what originally school was supposed to do. But now it's seen as a kind of a nasty station, like on the way to another place. Very few people go to college thinking this is where I'm going to stop. Everybody is on their way somewhere else. So college often, I think, becomes a place that holds people up unnecessarily. People think, man, if I could just do this in 2 years, I get the same punch for it, I would. I don't want to be here for 4 damn years. And that's just college. I mean, but high school and college, what a long, tedious drag that is. For many people who have incredibly active brains and tender spirits, you know, college is the first step in what ends up being a life of crippling defeat and anxiety. And that can happen just going to school, sitting in a stupid classroom, listening to something that some professor thinks is interesting that you don't know how to connect to. And then you do the same thing at work for the rest of your life and you're Dilbert, you know, that is office space, or that is that kind of existential problem. And I think college carries that. It can very easily turn people into cynics.
I think Daniel and I both had this experience where we actually enjoyed a lot of parts of school and still felt pretty burned out and didn't really end it on the best note possible. But then it was interesting to coming out of school, I sort of thought, man, I got so burnt out and kind of bummed out by the end of it. I must just not like working hard, or I must not like engaging in this kind of thing. And then getting it into the workplace, I suddenly realized that I really actually do enjoy work. I love problem solving and I love working on teams and I love figuring projects out and researching and whatever else. But it felt like when you are in those final steps of school, you're sort of being dictated to about how to do your work, how to what you ought to be focusing on and how you ought to focus on it. And then you get out into those first few years of your career and all of a sudden it starts to actually feel like your own. And at least in my experience, that was extremely motivating. And it felt like a really massive change between my final year in college and my first year of my career. That was just my experience. But I don't know, does that ring true for you guys at all?
It does for me. Taking ownership of my work took decades, honestly. I mean, it happened in creeping ways in graduate school and after graduate school, but creeping, not all at once.
Even with this podcast, it's like there's no one grading you on the podcast. You're not living up to any single person's kind of rubric for how this ought to go.
Yeah, except for our esteemed patrons.
Yeah, except for the patrons. It just feels like this is my project. This is my work, and I need to make it as good as possible in the shortest amount of time, which is really fundamentally different from how school felt to me.
Yes,
I think I definitely like established a lot of like destructive patterns in college with regards to like how I approached everything, right? From like work to a social life to, you know, everything else. Like, the way that I balanced those things and what I saw as opposing forces that weren't, you know, like, I love the way that you're talking about, you know, being a poet in an office, right, as being able to be like one holistic thing, right? Mm-hmm. And I've always been really interested, and I actually think about this a lot, I've been really interested in the, I don't know if this is actually a person I know or whether this is just like a cliche archetype that I've heard about, but the person in the office who has like a thing that they do on the side really, really well that no one knows about until they make it big and quit the job to go pursue their dream, right?
And it's Ron Swanson with the saxophone playing.
Right, exactly. It's like there's someone out there who's like, you know, been gigging, you know, every weekend the whole time that they've been working at, you know, at whatever job. And then all of a sudden, everything comes together on their side project and they quit their main job. That could never be me at this point, because it's impossible for me to, A, like, not be like pretty proud of everything that I do and like want to share it with the people I work with, sometimes to like an annoying level where I'm like spamming Slack with links to my podcasts and stuff. Hi, Dan and Matt. But also, like, I don't think I would enjoy that at all, you know, like having those two sort of separate existences where like one is just like funding the other, right?
Yeah, that's and good.
But I think that when I was in college, I sort of established those patterns, and it took me a while to like come to a place where I felt like I could actually be a whole person, you know, and I think I'm still learning that. But you know, I established the patterns of like, hey, like these are my friends and these are things that I do for fun and this is enjoyment and like this is, you know, this is true expression over here. And then like this is like waking up at a certain time and going to a class and like, you know, blah, 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 and writing a paper and going to the library. And this is busy work that I do to like justify my existence here, right? Like I'm in college for the experience of being in college, and I have to like be, you know, a low level academic for the right to be here. And at a certain point it became obvious that like, I could no longer keep up with the busy work of being a valuable community member at Covenant College, right? There was a lot there about being a holistic person that I didn't grasp. And I think other people around me grasped much better and had a better experience at college because of it. And I, you know, I think like at the end of the day, probably one of the, like I got kicked out of college, right? And I think a large perspective that I've sort of gained of like why that happened and why I couldn't like, I couldn't have taken any of the easy off ramps, is that I was like constantly fighting that battle of like, am I this person or that person? Am I A or B? And I couldn't ever like join those two things together.
Skype is so terrible.
All right, he's gone. So.
What's up? What's his problem, really?
Oh, my God. This guy. I don't even know how we do it anymore.
It's like he can't think straight.
That's exactly what it's like. It's just like that.
Yeah, we typically, I don't know if you've listened to the show, but we usually take like non-topic stuff and kind of just like chop it up in a nonsense kind of way as interludes between the main topics. And so that's, we like to kind of like start recording early just in case there's any gold in those hills.
So it sounds like you're leading into a conversation about a bike shop.
Are they PC 850s? He's like, yep, and 950s.
It's like... It's 2:30 p.m.
Well, okay, I rolled out of bed at 1:50. Can I grab you and like forcefully pull you back to something you said about half an hour ago?
Sure.
This edit is going to be so fun. One of the things we talk about on here a lot is people doing creative work. And I'm really interested in how tools affect creative work, especially in the age of the internet, especially in the time when like a lot of people are making work in public, kind of on the internet, and have this sort of public-facing profile where they're interacting with people as they create new things. And I'm interested with you, you know, back when you were a young man making poetry kind of by the fireside with, a quill, I'm not sure. And then shortly after you, you know, started writing poetry, you were probably starting to type it out on a Macintosh, which must have been a big, big adjustment. Then the internet comes around and all of a sudden you're putting out the majority of your poetry first on a blog. And then Twitter comes around and you're kind of, as you're processing new ideas in real time, you're sort of putting those out there in front of all of your, you know, anyone who enjoys your poetry who follows you on Twitter. So you're getting kind of like a first chance to test out new ideas or process new information kind of in real time. And maybe some of the ideas that make it out of there eventually make it into your poetry. I'm curious if just the means by which you make things or the means by which you come up with new ideas or the context in which you come up with new ideas, which is now primarily on the internet,
right,
kind of like in social media space. I'm curious if that winds up actually shaping what's being created.
Yeah, it definitely does. I had it really, when you say you go from blogs to Twitter, you're skipping about 10 years of development with, for me, because I didn't get on Twitter until 2010. There were about 10 or 12 years in there where it was discussion groups, commenting on articles, weird stuff like MySpace, which was very fruitful for me because there was a MySpace blog, and that's sort of a social media blog. I mean, I guess that's what Facebook became, like a social media with a blogging commenting feature. But this was, I wrote poems in MySpace and put them up and got responses and actually met quite a few, either people that ran series, reading series, or people that wanted to run my work in some way. They were looking around on MySpace for good content, good poetry. I call it poetry. You may call it content, but I think we're saying the same thing. Yeah. So then, and Facebook has never been that good for me in terms of productivity. Certainly there is a sense of a need to make the machine happy. I have that feeling a lot.
Make the machine happy.
Well, I want to put something into the machine that, that makes it happy. It, it results in comments or retweets or hearts or smileys with tears coming out of the sides of them or that kind of stuff.
Right. It seems like there's the fundamental shift there in some way. It seems to be that you have kind of instantaneous and constant feedback, right?
It's a quick feedback cycle, right? So the temptation is to put cheaper stuff in it to get feedback quicker. So in that sense, it's kind of like a drug, I guess, where you do anything for a fix. And would a gentleman would save up for 6 months and then get some really good heroin, you know, but a person that was desperate would just do whatever they could and they would end up ruining their lives, you know?
Hmm. Have you ever heard of Ken M?
Pan Am?
Yeah, Pan American Airlines? No.
No, I haven't heard of that.
No, Ken M. He's sort of a... He's sort of a notorious... Not really notorious, but he's a guy, and he's a troll, an internet troll, but a good one, you know, the pure old internet trolls, and he has no sort of central location, but there's a whole Reddit community sort of around tracking him around the internet, but most of his content gets created on comment sections on bad websites. Or Yahoo Answers comment sections, or like Yahoo News comment sections. And it's always excellent. And sort of his format tends to be he'll post a very dumb comment and then wait for several people to reply mocking him and then finish with like his punchline. And it's excellent. He's really, really good.
I read something, now that you're describing him, I read something about him not long ago, maybe 6 months ago. That was fascinating. That was kind of like a guy that uses comment space to make performance art.
Yeah, it's quite something. I'm looking at one right now. It's on an Epicurious article called The 10 Commandments of Perfect Mashed Potatoes.
That sounds like one of Aaron's poems.
Ken M. comments, also, it is healthier with no salt, and you can substitute the potatoes with mashed bananas. And Ted replies, yeah, a big serving of mashed bananas with my turkey is so delicious. Ken responds, we pour hot gravy on the banana mush, and then you stuff the turkey with the banana peels.
That's like comedy. I mean, that's like
it's excellent.
That's like conceptual comedy, like from the 60s or 70s.
You know, it's not. Yeah, it doesn't feel like it's that far off from like the, you know, the Thurber letters,
right? Or actually, what it's very similar to is Father Guido Sarducci's Laszlo letters. Have you ever read those? He's got at least one, maybe two volumes of letters that he wrote in the 70s to executives at big corporations.
Oh no.
Yeah.
And he would write like to McDonald's asking for something completely ridiculous or complaining about something completely ridiculous. And he would always show his letter and then the response that he got from the company.
That's excellent.
And it is well worth, I mean, it's similar to that kind of drawing people out on in this false landscape of brands, or should I call it a brandscape?
Oh yeah,
yeah. I think you should. I think you ought to.
What was that word I heard this week, John? I was telling you,
brandpocalypse.
No, brandemonium. It's a conference called Brandemonium. Oh my gosh.
And that was carried on later by Seinfeld. Kind of aped that in the 90s, right? Didn't he do a Letters from an Idiot? It was kind of along the same lines.
Did he? Oh, that's great.
Seinfeld published a book of anonymous letters that he wrote to, I think, corporations and politicians and things like that. It's pretty funny.
That's very similar. I once wrote a letter to Guido Sarducci, or Laszlo Toth is his real name. I said Guido Sarducci because he was an SNL character, this priest, like Italian priest with a big broad-brimmed hat. But I wrote a letter to Laszlo Toth and I never got a reply, which seemed very ironic.
And you know what I think is really interesting now to see is that a bunch of big brands, like I think famously Wendy's is one of them, has like seen this and seen that people love this kind of stuff on the internet and has actually like adopted it through some savvy social media team that works for that company. And so there's a bunch of like fast food chains and other brands that will like joke around with people on Twitter and like engage with that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. Which kind of kills it a little bit. But it's interesting to see how quickly that can evolve from the joke being on the corporations to pretty quickly the corporations figuring out how to try to be in on the joke.
Yep.
And people kind of eat that up as well.
Yep. Like the nugs thing recently with Wendy's. I did go buy some chicken nuggets at Wendy's as a result, and they were so bad.
I've been experiencing and living with and sort of transcending reality as a result of Cookout recently.
What's special about Cookout?
Well, first of all,
it's quite good.
The parking lot is very active. You can be hit by other cars in that parking lot. Like, I've almost gotten in an accident every time I've been there, and I have gotten in an accident one time I was there. It's a very serious parking lot.
So that's one selling point.
They got that. Then the menu board. You know, in a traditional fast food drive-thru, they have a menu board before you get to the microphone so that you can decide what you want. They just opted to not do that here. So what they have is a menu board with probably 50 items on it, all in the same size font, and organized very badly. And so what you do is you pull up in this drive-thru with 60 cars behind you, and you quickly parse this large board of white text to decide what you want.
Yeah, you made a lot of good points there. So it sounds like it's a place where you might get hit by a car, and you're definitely going to get a jam up in the line. But the burger's good.
Yeah,
the burger's excellent. There's no doubt about that.
And I'm glad you're here. Thanks for taking the time.
Oh sure, thanks. I'd like to say it's an honor.
Do you feel humbled?
I feel humble. I really just feel blessed, and that's largely because of you two guys.
You know what? You know what Ricky Horton said on the broadcast the other day? He said,
"Well, you had Ricky Horton on."
Well, during when the Cardinals were still alive.
Not on said, fits and starts.
No.
Ricky Horton said, you know what the great thing about baseball is that it's a game played by people who have either already been humbled or are just about to be humbled.
That's so good. Oh, that's life, though, isn't it? Isn't that life?
I know. I was like, well, that doesn't really just apply to baseball. That's all the great things that have been said about baseball are true of kind of everything.
Well, baseball is like life. I mean, baseball is like a crystalline version of life. It's just condensed because we do walk or run or touch stuff or catch stuff, you know, in real life. But in baseball, there are rules to that.
Yeah, that is actually one of the biggest differences between baseball and real life. That's rules.
Yeah, no. In life, it's often that you should touch things and catch things and run just sort of willy nilly as your heart leads.
Yeah, that's right. It's like tennis with no net.
Right. They might have started baseball by having a bunch of guys on the field just doing stuff.
Yeah, just living life.
Yeah.
And someone was like, we should introduce some sort of a structured framework really, for these nine men to stand on this field.
Some sort of structure on this. It's going to become unmanageable.
Oh, no, I don't think it was originally nine men. It was probably like 95 men, and they were just wandering.
And many of them had bats.
It was like, can we get this down to 10 at a time?
People throwing balls in any which direction.
What baseball without rules would look like? I mean, it would be much more aggressive, I think.
Well, this was explored in the world famous Bill Watterson comic of the 90s, right? This was Calvin Ball. This was Calvin and Hobbes playing Calvin Ball in the backyard, where they were keeping track of different scores of that measured different things. It was kind of beautiful.
That's great. You know, that's what your brother Nate and I used to do at games. We would introduce new rules, which. We didn't actually introduce them into the game, but we talked about what it would be like if one team scored three or more runs in one side of an inning, then in the next time they came to bat, they got to use aluminum bats. Or if they walked three times in an inning, then the next inning, the foul lines were widened by like 10 feet.
I think Pete Rose was doing that.
Yeah. Or Ty Cobb was, too. You know, I think this is part of what makes baseball so great, though, is that there's actually, like, numbers behind this. The veterans who, like, veteran pitchers and veteran batters actually get the benefit of the doubt on edge cases with umpires. They actually literally bend the rules for people who have had a sterling career.
Oh, that's that Tom Glavine slider 6 inches off the outside of the plate.
Yeah. They go, it was a good pitch, though, so we're going to call it a strike.
A Glavine ball looks like any other pitcher's strike.
Come on, don't be a milquetoast. That was a strike.
Just like life.
Well, so what do you guys want to chat about? I'm not trying to take the bull by the reins.
Oh,
horns.
No, not at all.
Stop trying to turn my life into baseball.
Yeah, please stop trying to impose rules on this.